Hello, everybody, and welcome back to yet another Science Studio program. This is Keith Pannell, and today we're going to have a very distinctive program. We're going to be talking to a Professor Zafra Lerman. She is the Distinguished Professor of Science and Public Policy, Emerita, at Columbia College in Illinois, Chicago. She's also recently been awarded the Science Diplomacy Award from the AAAS and the Andrei Sakharov Prize for 2016 from the American Physical Society. And that's all very recent. It's an amazing last few years. So, Zafra, welcome very much to Science Studio.
Thank you very much, and I'm glad to be on your program, Keith.
Well, I'm very happy that you're here after all these years. Before we get into all these incredibly prestigious awards, which all go to public policy, diplomacy, human rights, it's clear, tell us how you became a scientist to begin with. Where did you grow up, and what were the stimulations to make you a scientist?
I grew up in Israel. That was a developing country that we did not have chemistry kits like other people that became chemists. We did not have even toys by the time I grew up, but from a very, very young age, I remember myself very early, but at least from the 3 years old, I was all the time very fascinated by a lot of things that were happening around me and would go around to ask questions that usually not many people could answer. For example, I lived in Haifa, but when the radio talked, it says, "This is the voice of Jerusalem." And I was puzzled and tried to find the answer. How come I'm in Haifa and I can hear the voice of Jerusalem? So questions like that were already preparing me for being a scientist. Like a mirror was fascinating me. I always wanted to understand how come I see myself in the mirror. What is making this phenomena? So I knew I will become a scientist in a very, very early age. And then from the age of 7, I already could do algebra without anybody teaching me, and thought that mathematics will be very interesting. And then I heard about Albert Einstein and was trying to find books to read about him. And I thought my dream in life was to meet him. And when I grew a little bit older, somebody gave me the book on Madame Curie. And reading about Madame Curie, I got very fascinated in radioactivity. And from there, in isotope, and as a matter of fact, my research was working in isotope effects and reaction mechanism. And that started from the interest in what Madame Curie did.
And where did you go to school and university? In Haifa? In the Technion?
I went to the Technion, Israel Institute of Technology, for my bachelor and master degree. And then I went to the Weizmann Institute of Science in Israel for my PhD.
When you looked in the mirror, how did you actually know it was you that you were looking at?
I did not know it's me. And okay. It's very interesting story. I had neighbors that were identical twins, and I was playing with them since I was 2 years old, and I was sure I should have an identical twin. So I was asking all the time, where is my identical twin? And for a while, I was thinking that what I see is the identical twin. Yeah. And it took explanations by my parents that I don't have an identical twin like the two girls next to me. So the mirror was a big fascination for
me. I can believe that. After the Weizmann Institute, did you stay working in Israel, or did you come very early?
In the Weizmann Institute, when you get a PhD, and as you know, Israel is like an island in the Middle East. So the tradition is that you go for a postdoc,
right,
to Europe or to the U.S. And I had an offer to come and work with Frank Long at Cornell University, who was an excellent physical chemist, But in addition, he was very involved in, he was the first director of the Agency of Arms Control and Disarmament. He was a member of PUGWASH, that, for people that don't know, used to be the scientists from the Soviet Union and the U.S. that continue to all the time have meetings and talking.
And they always met in Nova Scotia, right? Up in Canada.
Exactly,
right.
That.
Very interesting.
Nova Scotia. Yeah. As a matter of fact, they got the Peace Nobel Prize after the fall of the Soviet Union. So I got very involved with him in a lot of other issues, not just doing research in chemistry.
Yes. Was it fortuitous, or did you choose to go there to Cornell because you knew of your professor's extra activity?
I knew because I was invited already as a graduate student very early to a Gordon conference on isotope effects and to give a talk because I found something on the secondary isotope effects that was unknown, and I was invited to talk about that, and this is where I met Professor Long at the Gordon conference and immediately was fascinated by all his activities.
Okay, so that's, I mean, there are not, I must tell you, in my opinion, there aren't enough scientists who take time to look at the bigger issues. And so let's move on then to this very prestigious Andrei Sakharov Award that you got, the prize, from the American Physical Society. So let's back off and you tell the audience a little bit about how you got to meet Sakharov, because I think you did, and what was all that about, and what's your role and your future in this arena of public human rights as a scientist?
By the way, I think I'm the only non-physicist that ever got this award, and probably the only woman, too.
Well, they probably think that you know, nuclear chemistry and isotopes is close enough to physics that you can sleep under the door.
Correct them when I got the prize. I said, no, I'm different. I got involved in human rights, as I said, while I was still working with Frank Long. But the American Chemical Society in 1986, under pressure from other human rights groups that most of the societies already had a committee and the ACS did not have a committee, decided in 1986 to form a subcommittee on scientific freedom and human rights, and I became the chair and served in this position till 2011 when they decided that this committee was not needed anymore, this subcommittee and the board can deal with the issues of human rights. But during that time, we worked very hard with a lot of cases all over, but sure, the Soviet Union was one of the main human rights places that we concentrated on.
And you mean by concentrating on is the fact that the committee, subcommittee, would get input from around the world, from scientists who were being in one way or another persecuted in their own country. And this dossier of each person came to that subcommittee, and then you began to be proactive on their behalf. That's the way it worked?
Exactly that. And the numbers were amazing coming from the Soviet Union because we worked on scientists. They were hundreds and hundreds of scientists. And during that time, they were called refuseniks because refused a lot of things that the government wanted. And they by themselves wanted to emigrate out of the Soviet Union and were removed from their jobs. Few were sent to labor camps, and few were in jail. So it was a very big group of people that really suffered from abuses in human rights. And it started by a group, but then we worked with them too. They called it SOS, Sakharov, Orlov, and Sharansky, yes. That were the three big issues that came to the attention of the world that they were already arrested and Saint Sakharov was sent to exile, but Orlov and Sharansky were sent to jail.
Well, Sakharov
became a symbol because he is the father of the hydrogen bomb in the Soviet Union, but then he devoted his life to peace and human rights and was awarded the Peace Nobel Prize. But when he demonstrated strongly against abuses of human rights, against the invasion of Afghanistan by the Russians, he was sent to exile to Gorky, where no foreigner could visit him. He was isolated from continuing to do his work, and he became really the symbol of fighting for human rights.
Gorky is the city that is now called Nizhny Novgorod, right there on the Volga.
Nobody could visit him.
No.
And it was a very big case that all the human rights groups around the world worked on his behalf.
How did you meet him, Zafra? How did you get to visit the Soviet Union very often?
I was going to the Soviet Union in order to meet with these dissidents. So I went into the Soviet Union always with a group, like, or a tourist, or we went to a group American Institute of Chemists, or a group of people from the American Chemical Society. So I couldn't go by myself and do human rights because they would not have given me a visa. But with the group, we were going to visit different universities, making lectures in different institutions. And at night, after midnight, I would sneak out and meet one of these dissidents in one of the dark alleys, and then we would walk and collect many more, and then meet like with 50 dissidents at a time in a dark alley at like 1 o'clock in the morning, and I would bring them some scientific magazine. Was illegal by that stage to bring it to the dissidents in the Soviet, but the most important thing that I could bring there back their CV, if I would be caught with that, I would need another committee to work on my behalf to release me from jail. But I was on the executive committee of the Albert Einstein Peace Prize, that one of the activities of this group was to give a peace prize every year to somebody that devoted their life to peace. And Andrei Sakharov, when he was released from Gorky, I think it was 88 or 89, we gave him the award, and he came to the U.S. to receive the award, and I had the chance to talk to him. This is when I realized that I had to talk to him through a translator because he didn't speak English, but he told me that if I want really to be successful in my work in human rights and make sure that my translator is not somehow related to the KGB, I better take a course in Russian.
Zafra, we have to take a break here. You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell, and we're talking with a very, very interesting lady, Professor Zafra Lerman. She is the Distinguished Professor of Science and Public Policy Emerita at Columbia College in Chicago, and we'll be back in one brief moment. Welcome back to Science Studio. This is Keith Pannell with Professor Zafra Lerman, the Distinguished Professor of Science and Public Policy Emerita at Columbia College in Chicago. And Zafra, you were saying that this is how you got finally to meet Andrei Sakharov. And did you get to meet him at all in Russia or in any of these trips, or was that just not
No, I met him in the U.S.
Only in the U.S.
Because he died very few years after that, very fast, sadly enough. But after his advice, I took a crash course in Russian, and this made my work much easier, being able to speak Russian while I was going to the Soviet Union.
So nowadays, obviously, the situation with the ex-Soviet Union and now Russia has sort of ameliorated to a large extent. I go, and I have done for about 20 years, to Russia, and it's much more open. And I've been, in fact, to Gorky, Nizhny Novgorod. I've been to the nuclear power stations even. So it's a much more open society. It's
but
not perfect.
There's a lot of human rights problems.
Well,
we had a lot of cases.
Yes, that applies to
that
a lot of places.
On after it became Russia, not
right.
Soviet Union. Human rights is now a big, big problem all over the world.
Right. So then let me go to the next stage of your really interesting story. 9/11, I mean, that had an impact around the world. And tell us how that began to impact you and your idea of utilizing science diplomacy, if you like, and public policy and human rights. What was the transformation that came around your particular
After 9/11,
activity?
Our subcommittee on scientific freedom and human rights discussed the fact that scientists have an obligation to really use their knowledge, status in society for the betterment of humankind. Science can prolong life, but science can cut life short. None of this weapon of mass destruction, if it's nuclear, chemical, or biological, can be done without scientists. So we felt very strongly that scientists have the responsibility now to get involved using our science as a bridge to peace. The American Chemical Society, the chair of the International Activities Committee, was by that stage, as a matter of fact, he's from Texas, our own Bill Carroll. And he asked every subcommittee to come with some great idea outside of the box that ACS can really make a change. And by that stage, I came up with the idea that we should organize a conference of top scientists from all the 15 Middle East countries, including Iran, Turkey, Israel, Syria, all the Middle East countries that you hear about, and have a conference for 5 days where they can meet each other, where they have a platform to freely talk with each other what they could not do otherwise, because the governments did not have any diplomatic relations with each other, and many times even a hostile relationship, and develop collaborations on issues that cannot be solved by one country: water scarcity, quality of the air pollution. These countries are very close to each other, and they must work together in order to solve big issues that can be solved only by science. And we felt that by developing a platform where they can develop scientific collaboration, develop friendships, overcome the chasms of distrust and intolerance, this can be a cornerstone to start really building peace in the region, and it will be our contribution as scientists. So the first time I suggested it, every subcommittee gave a suggestion. When it came my turn, it was silence in the room for quite a while till people could absorb even what I suggested. But this was the seed to start the Malta conferences. The idea was, how will we really get the scientists? How will we get Iranian, Palestinians, Syrians, and Iraqi to be ready to sit with Israelis in the same room for 5-6 days? So the idea was, we will invite 6 Nobel laureates, and then we'll send a letter: where else would you have a chance to be in such a ratio for 6 days with 6 Nobel laureates, and then even the governments will allow their scientists to come. And this was a good calculation, because this is really how it worked.
I mean, that was a very clever idea. I mean, first of all, using Malta, the little island off the southern part.
The reason of Malta is, yes, that because the first conference was in 2003, and it was the heights of the Intifada, and we were very afraid of which location can we feel safe. And an island, we thought, is much safer than the mainland. And Malta is a small island, 450,000 people only, very complicated to get to by that time because there were only three cities in Europe that you could make connection. So the calculation was that it wouldn't be worth for terrorists to go and waste a whole day to get to Malta just to kill a lot of Muslims and few Jews. So this is where Malta was selected as the venue for this conference.
So now, tell me, the first Malta conference, I think, was 2003, correct?
Correct.
In Valletta, that's the capital of Malta.
Right.
And
correct.
Now you have meetings every 2 years, correct?
Every 2 years. The reason right. it's only every 2 years is the funding, because we are all a group of volunteers, all of us scientists, or still professors or retired professors, few are in industry, but we raise the money by ourselves. We don't have one paid staff members, so we appeal to our friends, family, colleagues, anybody that we know to help us to support this conference because we have to pay for all the Middle East
right.
people to come. We are by ourselves are paying our own expenses, because we believe very strongly in the cause, and we write proposals, and we had already 7 conferences, so we have a cadre of more than 500, 600 scientists that participated in one way or another. We have collaborations going on water, what we need this collaboration, otherwise one country cannot work on this issue. We have, as a result of the Malta conference, we have Palestinian students doing their PhD at the Weizmann Institute in Israel. We had a sabbatical by one of the distinguished Palestinian scientists spending a year sabbatical at the Weizmann Institute of Science, what was an unbelievable thing to do.
Do you still have that policy of inviting Nobel laureates to each
yes,
of your meetings? That's such an important...
For the safety of the participants, because a lot of these countries make it very clear that they cannot participate with Israelis, but these countries want their scientists to be able to interact with the Nobel laureates, and the ratio that is 1-17 or 1-20, so sure, yes, the Nobel laureates are a very important part, and we had already 15 Nobel laureates that participated, most of them several times.
Do the Nobel laureates also volunteer their own funds for this, or is that subsidized?
Many of them, yes. It's very interesting because the Nobel laureates that participate believe in the cause, do it for the cause. They work with the scientists in this different workshop. We have the workshop on environment, air and water quality, nanotechnology and material science, energy resources. We have chemistry, safety, and security, and the Nobel laureates are participating with the Middle Eastern scientists in all these workshops. And the atmosphere is that everybody is equal. One important rule, no spouses, no accompanying members can come. Because as chemists, we all of us know that when you dilute a solution, the interaction is much slower, right? So we don't want to dilute the interaction.
Very clever. No infinite dilution here, right? Just as concentrated and focused as you can get it.
Everybody in the same hotel. Everybody eats all the 3 meals together, the coffee breaks together. We have plenary lectures by the Nobel laureates, but then the workshops that are very important.
So when is the next meeting, which should be 2017, correct?
December 2017. We just had the last one in November 2015. In Morocco was the last one.
Mallorca.
This one is going back to Malta.
Oh, right,
and
lovely.
We were invited to UNESCO during the International Year of Chemistry, 2011. They wanted one of the last events of the International Year of Chemistry in December 2011 to be the Malta Conference in their own headquarters in Paris.
Down here at the University of Texas at El Paso, we're on the border with Mexico, and we have a big environmental science and energy, or environmental science and engineering program down here. And we have been inviting scientists from Israel and from Palestine to come over here on exactly the same basis, that they come over to El Paso, of all places, and have conferences and meetings with engineers and scientists down here talking about things like water problems for the same reason. They can't meet together, even though they live only 5 to 10 miles away, but they meet here. And we claim that we have a very similar situation, that we've got two societies with different languages, both on different sides of the river, common problems with water. These ideas are out there, and it just takes some creative people, and you're obviously one of those at the highest level, to make things happen. It's been wonderful to have you here. You and I were on a committee about 21 years ago. The International.
And we spent a lot of time talking then.
Yeah, well, that's right, but not for 20 years. Professor Zafra Lehrman, Distinguished Professor of Science and Public Policy Emerita at Columbia College in Chicago. Thank you very much for being here on Science Studio.
Thank you very much, Keith, and I'm glad that we reconnected.
Jolly good. And I'd like to thank Norma Martinez for being the producer of this program. It sounds wonderful, and that's because of Norma Martinez. And we'll be back next week with another very different Science Studio. Thank you very much.